This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
From your boy Deshaun Foster, I'd like to give UCLA B team a shout out. Hope you guys keep up the good work.
The internet's number two UCLA sports podcast. I am Nathan Eberhardt. With me tonight is Michael Hanna. Hanna, let's go ahead and take care of some of those other questions that we had left over from last week. But before we do that, we have big news in the world of Pac-12 college sports.
Yeah, we have the official successor to Luxury Larry.
Yeah, white smoke coming out of the chimney of the luxury offices in San Francisco.
Habemus Commissioner
Yeah, yeah. So this George Kliavkoff. That's how I'm choosing. I don't know if it's Kliavkoff, whatever. But he is a former exec from MGM Corporation. And yeah, he's been announced as the new commissioner of the Pac-12. The big takeaway for me is that it wasn't someone from sports, and it wasn't someone from, in particular, college sports or college football. There are some positives to take away from this, obviously. I think that, you know, clearly you have someone who's, you know, who has a background in the entertainment and media landscape, as well as someone with roots in Las Vegas because of MGM's large footprint there. And that is really just an opportunity for the Pac-12 waiting to be seized is to leverage the asset that is Las Vegas and the media, you know, behemoth that it is. And he has had good things to say about, you know, what he plans to do. The big news coming away from his introductory presser, he finished his statement with, "I want to be clear, we know where the bread is buttered. We're focused on revenue sports and winning in men's basketball and football." So, I mean, that is encouraging because as we have talked about ad nauseum and as, you know, I think it was widely known, the other sports will do well when covered and, you know, protected, if you will, and funded by the eyeballs and money driven by the revenue sports. So it's doing that is not neglecting won't starve the revenue sports. It'll actually help them thrive. But all of that said, my main, you know, concern is just that we didn't get someone in sports, you know, with that sport background. And the argument I've heard put forward is that the Pac-12, you know, needs to think outside the box, that, you know, they can't do a traditional solution because of, you know, the uniqueness of the challenges and how far, you know, they've fallen behind. And so, you know, doing something like this is necessary. They have to be creative. But I just wonder why we have to be creative, because we haven't tried, you know, solid, competent, you know, insider expert on this stuff. Like, I don't know Tom Hansen's background, but competent wasn't part of it. And, you know, Larry Scott came in with all sorts of grand visions, but, you know, none of the, I don't want to say character, but, you know, none of the follow through and none of the ability to make that happen. Meanwhile, there isn't a complete erosion of the health of the, you know, the main, you know, programs of the conference and the generators of revenue and health for the conference. So how do we know that just hiring someone who knows what it is to, you know, do football or basketball operations for a high level conference and have them like take one step up the ladder, whether from another conference or whatever, or someone in sports administration, you know, college sports administration wouldn't do it? Like why take another big risk? I'm wondering.
It's a very good question. My immediate reaction when I saw the MGM connection was that, and he wasn't just involved with MGM as like general MGM, the hotel chain. He was specifically involved in hold on one second, let me pull it up.
Well, MGM is also the movie company, right?
Like it is. He came from MGM Resorts, okay. And he was the president of entertainment and sports. Okay. So he particularly oversaw like the relationships they had with the Pac-12 for hosting the Pac-12 tournament, boxing matches and all that kind of stuff. I think he sat on the board of Cirque du Soleil and all this kind of stuff. So that's what I saw on Twitter anyway. My immediate reaction was, and also he was on the board of BetMGM, which is one of the three biggest bet gambling companies in the world. So my immediate reaction was, wow, the Pac-12 presidents are making an explicit turn into gambling as an unexplored revenue source. And that's going to be the way that they steal a march on their rivals before rival conferences, before naturally the rival conferences do the same thing, but just make more money out of it because there's more to mine from them. But regardless of that, the more I dug in his background, I see why they did it. And he was on the board of governors of the WNBA. He was the managing partner of the Las Vegas Aces WNBA franchise. He worked at Hearst Entertainment and syndication, oversaw their interests in cable television networks, including ESPN. Hearst is one of the minority owners of ESPN. Disney is not the whole owner of ESPN. They are by far the majority owner.
And Hearst, I assume, is the legacy company of William Randolph Hearst.
Correct.
Media.
It okay. is indeed. He was the digital chief digital officer at NBC Universal. He worked at he was the executive vice president who oversaw the corporate development and business development of MLB Advanced Media, which came to be known as BAMTech. I think you've heard of that, right?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay. So let me. If you stream sports, there is a 90% chance that what you are watching is something that uses the BAMTech platform. It started out because MLB TV was kind of groundbreaking in the quality of the streams that it had and the reliability of the streams that it had. And so it basically spun off MLB Advanced Media into its own separate arm called BAMTech. And they franchised out the use of their streaming platform. ESPN uses, I know this for a fact because ESPN bought a huge stake in BAMTech. ESPN uses BAMTech. HBO Max uses BAMTech for streaming movies. NHL TV, I know, uses BAMTech. And I want to say that the NFL streaming media is on BAMTech as well. But like, it is probably the, it was the oasis for MLB owners for a while before they just started raking it in hand over fist from more traditional revenue sources. But I mean, it was found money for MLB. That's what I was trying to say. BAMTech being as wildly successful as it was. So having a hand in not only owner, I don't know, how do I want to put this? Partial ownership of ESPN, streaming, working for major broadcast organizations like NBC, working in the gambling side of things with BetMGM, overseeing sports and entertainment properties with MGM. I get the idea of what they're trying to do. It is even if it's not an explicit turn in towards gambling, it is an explicit turn in towards the Pac-12 is a media rights organization. At the end of the day, the Pac-12 exists to generate as large profits as possible from media rights. And that is going to be the thing that kind of filters down into individual sports, so on and so forth. But they are looking for someone to maximize and wring out every dollar possible from media rights. And so I get the logic behind it in that way. Somebody who has had fingers in all those cookie jars, all those potential revenue sources, untapped revenue sources in many ways, would be a hire that might be able to get you closer to where you want to go than somebody who is more of like a college sports insider in that way. I get the logic behind that. The thing that scares me, even though his resume is more extensive than Larry Scott's, is the similarity to Larry Scott in terms of he's an outside the box thinker who's coming out from outside college sports to refresh it and give it this vision that it didn't have before, and to once again tap into untapped revenue sources and so on. So you could, even though I think Kliavkov is far more qualified coming into the job than Larry Scott ever was. Larry Scott ran the WTA, which impressive organization, of course, but that was it. Kliavkov has a far more diverse resume from what I can tell here. He also has his law degree from the University of Virginia. I get why that kind of a diverse resume, considering the landscape that is confronting the Pac-12 right now and the need to get it to get even in, or as close to even as possible in the financial arms race, how that was the entirety of what they were looking for at the end of the day. And they want somebody who can do all that. But at the same time, the Pac-12 has gone this route and struck out before. I worry that it will happen again, but there's really no way to know until a year or 2 years down the road when they've negotiated their media rights deal. There's a difference between, oh, wow, this is really competitive with the rest of the market. And, oh, wow, there's this. What I'm trying to say is basically if the Pac-12 ends up resetting the market, we just know that the other four conferences are going to just do better than the Pac-12 when they do their own reset. So the Pac-12 is going to end up where it started in that sense. If they find a guy who is able to basically create a strategic vision for how, now he's not responsible for this in any way, shape, or form, but vision does filter down from the top in the corporate world. And if he is able to lay out a strategic vision where the revenue sports winning games creates value in and of itself that leads to profits down the road and the health of overall athletic programs, then that is a guy who is 100,000 times better than Larry Scott.
Sure.
Hopefully he said the right things. We know where our bread is buttered. There's risk in this, but I can kind of see why they did it as well.
2 points for me, based on stuff you've said. One, temperamentally or dispositionally, right? I feel like there, you know, one of the ways you can divide people into two groups. There's, you know, there are early adopters and there are, you know, whatever you want to call the late adopters, if you, you know, I guess. You know, there are people that want to be the beta testers, the first users of every new technology. They want to be on the cutting edge. And there are others who hang back and be like, well, I'm going to see, is this a fad? I'm going to see, is this, you know, I'm going to wait till they get the kinks ironed out that, you know, that wait till this is a stable technology and use it, right? That kind of thing. And the risk of being the early adopter person is that, you know, oftentimes, you know, stuff blows up in your face. You spend a lot of money on, you know, boondoggles and, you know,
studios in San Francisco.
Exactly. When you jump at every opportunity because you want to be first, right? The reward is that you're first and you look like a visionary. The risk though is that, you know, you end up just frivoling away your money and being an unserious person. And
also that other people are able to see what you did and they're able to leverage it better than you did.
Sure. But my point is just that there is no, I'm going to admit that there is no right or wrong in that. That is just a dispositional difference in personalities.
Sure.
And I am someone that is not that early adopter. Like I am not the like, ooh, there's a brand new thing, I want to try it out. Right. And so I just admit that I'm going to be personally skeptical in a non-rational, non-like, I can't actually base a judgment off this or encourage other people to believe this. I just recognize this about myself, that I am less likely to be on board with something that says, hey, we're going to leapfrog the next step in development. We're not going to catch up with what we did wrong. We're going to go ahead and innovate our way to the next thing. Like that's just, it's always going to seem suspect and overly risky to me. And so I hope that my, you know, my natural suspicions, will not bear out in this case, but that's where they are and that's where they come from. At least, so I guess I want to at least understand my own biases, if you will. My second point though, in an illustration that a way to think about what you're talking about and about how it would, you know, look well or how it would look good if it does well. Is, you know, there is this idea in, you know, international development or, you know, economic development literature that, you know, every country, every culture goes through the same paces. First, you have to build this capacity and then this one and this one, and you grow like that. Obviously, it's, you know, problematic or whatever, but that's a big, you know, that's a big understanding of like, okay, well, if this developing country, this quote unquote third world country wants to get to, you know, a level of affluence or you know, economic viability, then they need to go through these steps that, you know, these other countries did 150 years ago. And one of the challenges to that idea, one of the things that we're seeing that disprove that is that, you know, you look at a lot of like sub-Saharan Africa over the last 20 years, you know, they did not have the same kind of physical infrastructure that, you know, modern service economy was based on, you know, but they were some of the first early adopters of, you know, being able to use mobile for, you know, small business, you know, whether it be small business microloans or, you know, that kind of stuff that ended up being well adapted for what they were doing. And we have seen huge growth in, you know, the development of sub-Saharan Africa because they essentially, like you said, had their whatever their position was on this hypothetical development ladder and skipped it. And they said, okay, we're not going to do the intermediate steps. We're just going to do the next thing. And that's going to get us caught up because we know how, you know, and obviously it wasn't, I don't know that it was like, you know, a bunch of people got together and made this as a collective decision, but that's the way it's kind of played out. And to me, that's a way of wrapping my mind around what this idea of like, you know, we missed out on the network, you know, thing. But if we can get to, you know, micro streaming, micro targeting, you know, disaggregated or unbundled access to sports plus revenue from, you know, the loosening regulations around gambling and sports, you know, setting aside whatever ethical concerns you may or may not have with that, right? That is a path that I at least can see spelled out and it is intelligible to me as a way that this kind of strategy might actually play out.
I agree with you on the thing you brought up at the end, especially that this guy's background, NBC Universal, Chief Digital Content, BAM Tech, Hearst Digital Properties, everything screams about him besides the Las Vegas stuff. Well, when you include the Las Vegas stuff, the MGM stuff, it screams like next frontier, digital streaming and gambling. And the combination of the two, live gambling during digital streaming, like that is going to be the next frontier. But I know that college sports has quite often been at the forefront of changes in media. College sports were the first ones, basketball and football, that primarily played out on cable rather than terrestrial television. The NBA has subsequently gone almost exclusively to cable, except for the NBA finals. The NHL is almost exclusively on cable, except for like four games of the NHL Stanley Cup finals. MLB has terrestrial, half terrestrial, half cable playoffs, and the World Series all on terrestrial. The NFL is unique in that it is the one league that is able to get the legacy players to pay up because it is the only one that is just, you know, it is solid gold. But everybody else has made the transition to cable almost exclusively behind the lead of college sports. Is college sports going to be the forerunner of the transition to digital street, the Netflixing of sports, basically going to over the top services like a Peacock, screw Peacock, by the way, for so many reasons, ESPN Plus, Paramount Plus, so on and so forth. Is college sports going to be at the forefront of that? And is the Pac-12 potentially going to be an early adopter? Now, there's risk and reward in that. The reward is that you might just get a huge windfall. Like La Liga, the Spanish premier soccer division, just signed a massive deal with ESPN relative to what you would imagine they could get from general interest in their league beyond two teams. We've seen it with soccer rights in the U.S., where they are putting it on these over-the-top services and paying for the content. There's risk and reward in that. For soccer leagues, there's no risk because it's such niche content that people who want it are going to go find it. For college sports, though, there's huge risk in it. The reward is potentially massive because because you can actually ascertain the exact amount of eyeballs that are watching games. Therefore, you can you can peg revenues to eyeballs if you wanted to. That'd be hugely risky, though. But there is incentive in the networks doing this in order to have premium content to build up their over-the-top streaming services. For the Pac-12 specifically, for a league that doesn't get the casual eyeballs the way that the SEC or the Big Ten do, is it worth it to kind of say, you know what? Our niche fans are our niche fans. We can make more money being on ESPN Plus than we can being on FS1. Do you think that's worth it to the Pac-12? Or do you think that we are in such a lull in terms of quality of the teams that if there is an emphasis on the quality of the teams being built up again, that the Pac-12 will go back to attracting eyeballs in the way that it was previously? Not on the level of the SEC and the Big Ten, but perfectly solid enough to be considered a big boy. Do they take themselves out of the big boy conversation if they go to behind an over-the-top paywall?
Are you asking that as a question, or are you putting that forward as a rhetorical illustration of what is at stake?
Both.
I do not have an answer.
No. It's clear that the Pac-12 is thinking about it because you don't make this hire without that being a serious consideration on the table. A guy whose career is in gambling and digital media.
Yeah.
So it's clear that they're thinking about it, or that he, by some referral, was able to get an interview and made them start thinking about it. One way or another, this is another fork in the road for the Pac-12. The creation of the Pac-12 network and the pursuit of the Pac-16 was the last true fork in the road. This, I think, these upcoming media rights negotiations and the path that they forge going forward is the next fork in the road. maybe there's an integration of the Pac-12 network into something like an ESPN Plus, and ESPN Plus finally, ESPN finally gets their stake in the Pac-12 network, and they pay them an extra premium even for being the league that agreed to put their network behind that over-the-top paywall. So it's so fascinating. There's so many implications, potential implications behind this hire, what it could potentially mean, and the potential for the Pac-12 to be trailblazers. The problem with being trailblazers, like I said, is that you get the first cut of money, but the guys who see that you are making more than you should, that you're making money above your station, will realize then that, like, oh, I can do that and make even more. And the Pac-12 ends up back where it is, and we think that Kliavkov is a huge failure at that point. And we say, yeah, thanks for doing it this way, but, you know, everyone else did it and they did it better. And we think it was Larry Scott at that point.
I mean, that's part of the innovator's curse, right? Is that everyone catches up to you and then you have to keep doing it. Or somehow do something to at least leverage that advantage you have for as long as you have it to even the playing field once they catch up. But yeah, I don't even know. One of the questions that I have, though, is I guess part of when he says we have to get the revenue sports right, you know, presumably he means the televising and access and bringing in the revenue for it. Because one of my worries, and I what I'm saying now is this may be a groundless worry, is by not having someone with a background in college sports, I think that comes from conceiving of the conference commissioner as essentially being like the AD of ADs. Right? Like, you're the athletic director of the athletic directors in your conference, you know, kind of like the bishop is to the priests in the diocese, right? It's like the, you know, one level up. But that's not necessarily the case. It is a different, more outward facing role than actually administering a university's athletic department, right?
It is definitely. And it's similar in that he answers to all the conference presidents the way that Nady would answer to his individual campus's president. But it is a far more outward facing role. You take a lot more heat for things that you might not be as involved in. You don't get really as much praise, but your role in kind of, you have a tone setting vision, overarching visionary kind of a role in a way that an average AD wouldn't. An average AD has control over their athletic department, but they owe their employment to the president that hired them and the boards of regents that keep them on, similar to the way that a conference commissioner does. But an AD has a far more limited scope of a job. You are focused on these sports winning, glad-handing donors, so on and so forth. A conference commissioner at the end of the day is a media executive. That's what the position has become. It's somebody who answers to college.
That's a development, right? That's not something that's always been true.
No. This is the last 20 years or so.
Okay.
The role of a conference commissioner is to manage media relationships, extract maximum value for them, and have that value filter down to the ground level so that the product that you are selling continues to be marketable and desirable. So that's where the sport part comes in. You're getting this money so that you can win on the field, so you can make more money and create a virtuous cycle of sorts. Yeah. If you're thinking about it from a financial perspective.
Sure.
So it is similar to, he has to answer to the conference presidents the way that the AD has to answer his own individual president. But the way I started this, but he is more of a media executive. The AD is more of a kind of ground level grassroots, developer and nurturer of a program. So they're both leadership roles who answer to similar levels of people, but the functions of the job are of the individual jobs are fundamentally different.
Okay. All right. Speaking of ADs, we had a question left over from last week from David Hamilton, who is a loyal listener of the show, longtime loyal listener of the show, who asks, is there a better AD in college sports than Martin Jarman for rooting on the team and growing the fan base? And then his question is, but will his enthusiasm infect the coaches and result in more winning and titles?
So I wonder who he's referring to there.
There are two two-step questions here. Like, we've talked a little bit about the first one, right? That it is, you know, we are still kind of getting used to, still marveling at, still, you know, expressing gratitude for the fact that, you know, we've gone from one extreme to the other in terms of visibility and energy and
willingness to, not just engage the fan base, but get the fan base then to engage in the teams, between Dan Guerrero and Martin Jarman. I have marveled at his presence at all of the, non-revenue sport, events, and the way he publicizes that, and the energy he brings to his interactions with the players. They know him, they're excited he's there, in a way that I can't even ever fathom. I mean, if Dan Guerrero did that, they certainly didn't make it public, which is the big difference we're talking about here. But also, I can't even imagine him, being this, kind of cheerleader for all of the programs. And so, but he is anomalous in that, right? Like, one of the things, this is not just us coming back to a base level. This is what all ADs do. He is special in this regard. And I think that is something, that David points out in his question that is worth holding on to, that this is something that, it is an extra benefit to get that.
I'm going to throw a different adjective out there.
Please.
I know you're going to continue with the question, but I feel like this encapsulates it just as much. He's cool. In a way that most ADs are kind of creatures of the ecosystem. Martin Jarman is cool.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the difference with him.
And I say this without in any way taking away from, what he's doing, but I don't doubt that he's doing that on purpose. Like, that is a goal of his, to have that be his, his approach and his, that is something he is working at in a positive and, I'm not saying that as a take away from him or make it less genuine way. Like, that is something he wants to do, is be able to project an image of cool or one that is attractive in terms of wanting to say, hey, like, I like that vibe. I want to engage with that. And then to impart that or lend that to, the athletic department writ large.
Oh, of course. The cool AD kind of gets you... He is bringing profile to sports that wouldn't be getting it otherwise, because it's just cool to follow him and engage with him. I have a Twitter conversation with this guy. I'm going to follow him. Oh, I see he's at this game. I wonder what's going on there. Oh, that's a really good team. I'm going to start following. Like, it's a knock-on effect. It's the way that we say that sports are the gateway to the university. An AD who's able to connect with fans can be the gateway to growing a sports, a programs, or even larger than that's fan base. Yep. So. It is part of the job. He is putting on his shoulders in a way that Guerrero never would have dreamed of. They're totally different people. It's almost like,
wouldn't have even thought to, let alone known how to.
Yeah, exactly. He has the marketing part of this job down. Did you get his email this week?
I have it. I don't know that I read it.
Okay, but it was in your inbox, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a direct... I was at work and I... saw on my Google email app, I saw Martin Jarman's name pop up. I'm like, wait, what? And I can't imagine how many people saw that. I was just like, wait, Martin Jarman emailed me? Yeah. And it's different than when Dan Guerrero emails you, because it's like, oh, I know it's written by some marketing dude and it's some rote fundraising or ticket sales or whatever. With Jarman, it's like, oh, what does Jarman have to say? Because I know that I generally like what Martin Jarman has to say. So he has a level of trust and enthusiasm built in that Dan Guerrero didn't, which, they're different people. It's almost not fair to compare them.
And I'm not going
to
say
you go on to read it and it radiates this enthusiasm that he has. It's just like, we are elite at these, and these are the things you might've missed that we are elite at. He loves using that word, by the way. And that's one of my favorite words. So, I'm on board with all that. But just in general, you get the sense that this is a guy who he is aware of what his power is as in his job and wants to leverage it for maximum benefit, because it not only benefits his program, but it also benefits him professionally. The better he looks doing this job, the better. I don't know. I'm not saying he's putting himself out there for the Ohio State job. I'm not saying that quite yet. But at the same time, there is more of a perception that he's doing a good job if he has the fans on board. So everything he can do to keep them engaged. And I think he naturally just likes engaging with people. So I think it's just all of the above.
How does this translate, or how can this be translated into, actual team on the field success?
So, I mean, that's a kind of a, there's a couple things that go into it. One is the actual dollars and cents of the equation, being able to build up a donor base that could potentially lead to better facilities, better hiring for coaches, larger budget in general, so on and so forth. So there is a direct connection between being able to gin up enthusiasm between the people with the deep pocketbooks and success on the field. And then you have better atmosphere, like when fans can go start going to games again, which after the CDC's announcement today, seems like it's going to be this fall. You have better crowds. You have more enthusiastic crowds. You have younger crowds that add a cool factor that makes other people want to go. Like all of these things, laying the groundwork at the grassroots level breeds larger scale success. So you're growing the budget of the department by gaining enthusiastic donors who want to kind of gravitate to your energy. But those people are going to then, if also the people who don't have as deep of pocketbooks but have that same connection to your energy are going to then transfer your energy and kind of manifest it through their fandom in various ways. And they're going to create it. It is laying the seeds. It's almost in the inception of enthusiasm, both financially and enthusiastically. And so that it is a straight up marketing and hype job, but he's doing it to perfection so far. I'm so impressed by him.
The question that I get from David's question is essentially, is it possible to build this as a culture? You know, is this something that he has to do? And you're spelling out the way that can reap immediate benefits. Is this something that he can instill as a culture in all of the sports programs, in the athletic department writ large? Is this something that is, yeah, it can be lasting in that sense.
I believe so, because culture is built from not just within, but from the top down. Are you saying that he can build something that's built to withstand potentially his departure down the road? Say he's not, whether he's here for 5 years, 15 years, 25 years, whatever it happens to be. Is that what you're trying to say? Like, is he able to lay the foundation for something that is permanent in a sense?
That's part of the question. The thing I was thinking about mainly, though, was does it translate to the way that the teams run their program, the ways that the coaches run their program, like, is this something that, can be infectious?
That's a good question.
And does it need to be?
I think that culture in general needs to be infectious if it's a good culture. If it's not, it's like, it becomes noxious at that point. It's the wrong kind of infectious, but regardless of that, I believe a good culture can be infectious in terms of creating a wide scale appeal and pride in craft in certain senses. Like, for example, it is a privilege to play at UCLA. I need to act like it on a daily basis and live up to that privilege. It's hard for me to pinpoint something in football. Football right now has more commits. I believe they have more commitments and more four-star commitments, which is weird to say because they only have three, but they have more commitments overall and more four-star commitments by this point in a recruiting cycle than they have ever under Chip Kelly so far. I don't know whether that's Chip basically coaching and running a program for his job, knowing that he's on the hot seat, knowing that his buyout expires after this season, or whether that's something where it's kind of a mandate, not a mandate from on high, because Martin Jarman knows better than to tell someone who was explicitly promised that you'll get to run things your own way, that no, it's actually going to run this way. But it could be one of those things where he's just like, where he is having a subtle knock-on effect, or it could be just kind of Chip realizing that what he's doing needs to change. He's hired younger, he's hired more enthusiastic. So I think the two might, I don't know whether they're mutually exclusive or not, but I do believe that growing a culture of enthusiasm, of pride, and of kind of, how do I put this? Yeah, enthusiasm, pride, we'll just kind of leave it there, is something that can have a knock-on effect on performance, because it creates an atmosphere in which people want to show success and breed success in that sense. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can draw a direct line between Martin Jarman just being a cool guy who people want to hang out with and talk to, and support in his development of the athletic program as a whole, and going to the Final Four, for example. But I don't think that anything that he has done hurts that. And in fact, there's quite a few things that you can say have helped that. So, I mean, the story with Ryan Geese is becoming a national story. And that's just from him saying, you know what, we need every fan there that we can get. I'm going to give you my personal tickets and you're going to be my good luck charm. Like that kind of a thing is really cool. Going on every podcast possible. He was on the Athletics podcast with Stuart Mandel and Bruce Feldman. He wasn't on the Solid Verbal. There was another one he was on. Okay, so not everyone possible, but national podcasts. Being a media presence, being kind of a totem of enthusiasm. I think that is a tangible net positive that has knock-on effects down the road and can have immediately positive impacts as well. So in general, Martin Jarmond, there's nothing I can complain about so far. Everything sure. He's done, he has done just exceedingly well from everything that I can tell. The players like being around him. They like being Bruins more because of him. And I think that that leads to more winning down the road. There will become an inflection point. The Jordan Brand deal, obviously a huge deal for this fan base and something that did gain publicity nationally as well. The inflection point for Martin Jarmond is going to come in about 7 months. And that's going to come with how he has to handle Chip Kelly. If I'm not going to call him Charles for the sake of this conversation, this part, this is about contracts. So if UCLA wins this season, we can start calling him Chip again anyway. Then at that point, does he give him some sort of mammoth extension saying that, you know what? Okay, you proved it. So I'm going to give you this with this buyout and all that wonderful stuff. Does he continue to kind of keep him on a leash as far as like a kind of prove it thing until it seems more sustainable? Like, how does he handle either success or failure after this season? If UCLA does not have a good football season, he's going to can Kelly at that point. But where does he pivot? Who does he pivot to? What are the things that he prioritizes? Does he go with someone he has connections to, like a Jeff Half, the way he did Jeff Halfley when he was at Boston College? What is his Rolodex? Who, like, is he set on somebody being from somebody in his network? What are the things he prioritizes as qualities in the head of a football program? The head of the football program is probably the second most important job, if not the most important job, in the athletic department alongside the athletic director. So that is going to be the first or the second true inflection point for Martin Jarmond after the shoe deal with Jordan. He nailed that one. So now the football coach situation in about 7 months is going to be the next inflection point for him. And that's going to be the next real point where fans are going to be able to say, oh, wow, okay, this guy is really just, he's just freaking nails. Or, oh, man, he got that one wrong, so he's not perfect. Ugh, man, I don't know. You know, that's the next fork in the road for him, I think.
I think what it sounds to me is that, you know, we know he is good at the publicity and the public-facing stuff. The question is, once he has strategic decisions put to him, once he has actual, you know, athletic-minded, you know, success-based or success goal-driven decisions to make, and then we'll see if he has, you know, if he's up to snuff in that regard. I mean, obviously, the evidence that we have in at Boston College is promising, you know, but we would obviously want to see it, you know, here.
Of course, and the shoe deal was a step in the right direction in that, it built trust in that regard. Like, okay, his first priority was what is going to give us the. What is going to give us this aura of eliteness? And I'm just using that because that's what he emphasized. He emphasizes, even in that email he sent out to the fan base, being elite. And that's what he's emphasized at UCLA. That's what he's explicitly said at UCLA since he has been here. It's an elite university with an elite legacy. It is a program across all sports and program-wide that needs to be elite on every level. And that mentality appeals to me and makes me think that, okay, having been at Ohio State, I know that he knows how to identify, I know he knows football programs. And then having made the hire he did at Boston College, which is looking pretty decent at the moment, it makes me think, okay, he can spot the factors that make a good coach tick. And then we'll see where it goes from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a question that isn't on our list that,
sure.
You know, since you brought up the question of what to do with Chip Kelly. This is tangentially related. It just reminded me. Why? Basically, I'll put it out this way. We have gotten, you know, and this is not the first time in our podcasting, you know, career that we've done this or when we were writers either. we have gotten some flack from folks about being down on Chip Kelly, being down on the football program. And, always going to find a time to carp on this. We had a comment last week about, of course you Mora's been gone this, for so long, and yet you still took a chance to hit him and hit how he left. Like, explain to folks, and I got this too, this isn't just you. I've gotten this in stuff that I've said online. I've gotten this in stuff that I wrote when we were both writers at Gojo Bruin. Why do we do this? In a sense, like, what goal do you have when you talk negatively about, a current coach or a former coach or the state of a program? What goal are you, serving or trying to accomplish in that regard?
I mean, it's a great question. It's one you and I have talked about. I'm not sure I really have a goal in that regard. It's just, this is the question that's presented, and these are the facts as I know them. And I know that people try to sell themselves as, oh, I'm just plain spoken, telling you the facts as I hear them and I see them, blah, blah. I'm not trying to be folksy in any sort of regard. It's just basically like, oh, for example, Jim Mora, who are you mad at, Jim Mora or Kelly right now? And it's like, you know what? Based on what I know, the evidence tips towards Jim Mora being more at fault for salting the football field, so to speak, than Chip Kelly is in my mind based on what I know. So I'm just going to go with that. I don't really have any sort of I don't know any of these people personally. My interest is in watching a team that wins. I don't invest in this because I enjoy wallowing in misery. At the end of the day, the reason I got into
fooled me, but that's that's probably some of the snark that we're getting in trouble for. So
I know, right? But no, at the end of the day, the thing that I enjoy the most is watching teams that I like win games, because it just from an ego perspective, it validates my investment and my choice in choosing to prioritize this as something that I care about. But even beyond that, it's just cool and fun to kind of revel in good vibes, to go on Twitter and just kind of digitally high five everybody, to get texts from people like, oh my goodness, I can't believe you guys are in the Final Four. That's incredible. Who is this guy that they hired? Like all this kind of stuff, like Johnny Juzang. Where did this guy come from? Like that's the kind of stuff I enjoy. I don't enjoy bagging on my own team. I derive no pleasure from it whatsoever. But I feel like living in a land where you're not allowed to call a spade, because there's some sort of intangible negativity that's going to drift over through the cosmos to Westwood and permeate through and course through the veins of the people there and drag them down one way or another. I have no delusions about my own influence or power. I don't have any. I appreciate that we have listeners who enjoy listening to us give our takes on the things that we care about relating to this program. But at the end of the day, I think they enjoy it because it's just me and you just kind of talking as fans and the way that things make us feel. And they can relate to it in that way because they can imagine kind of sitting and talking with their buddies in the same way. They're having group chats and text conversations and phone calls, FaceTimes, tailgates, where they're talking in the same way about, oh man, I wish we ran the ball better. Why are we doing this, this, this? Oh, these guys seem like they're upset in this program. I don't know why this guy isn't able to build a better, we're just having conversations at the end of the day. So to kind of operate under the premise that what I say is going to have any sort of profound impact on the way things actually are is I don't have that level of delusion about my own influence. And so I think that the best way to approach this kind of a thing is just to call it, not to be like some sort of faux folksy to give some sort of faux folksy vibe or anything like that, but it's just to call a spade based on what I see in front of me. It's not negativity for the sake of negativity. It's negativity because we went 10-21 the last three seasons, because this is something where I do have a little bit more knowledge, but I know that the last coach didn't care enough about this program to stop it from deteriorating to a point where the team probably would have went 2-10 under him in that year after Josh Rosen left if he hadn't been fired that season. So, like, I don't enjoy this. I didn't enjoy the Alford years except for one year where we were winning in spite of him. And that was just a cool team to follow. I enjoyed following that team even if they had a coach I didn't like. I don't really care. Well, I do care who the figurehead of the program is at the end of the day, because if it's somebody like Steve Alford, who's just despicable on a human level, then whatever, that's not something I can get behind. But if it's Chip, who I don't want to have a beer with necessarily, if he's winning, I don't care if I want to have a beer with him. Win the damn games. That's all that's all I care about. Develop the players as athletes and as men and as scholars, and you have my full support. I don't really care about the charisma of the figurehead. You can be Nick Saban for all I care, or you can be, I don't know, who's a really cool and charismatic coach, like a Steve Kerr or something like that. I don't really care one way or another. If you win games, you develop people, you develop students, you are doing every aspect of the job at that point, and I'm going to get behind you regardless. So I don't go into this for I know this is a very long-winded thing, and I know you got plenty to say about this as well, so I'm sorry for stealing anything.
Well, I asked the question, so.
I know. But I know you have a decent amount to say about this as well, but I don't go into this wanting to be negative for the sake of negativity. I want to talk about cool things, but you have to also be realistic about what's going on in front of you. A coach is not – there are fans who conflate the coach and the staff with the school and the program. And at the end of the day, my priority is the benefit of the school and the health, the success, the benefit of the school and the program. Coaches are paid mercenaries at the end of the day, by and large. Very, very, very few create a genuine connection between themselves and the place. There have to be either longstanding connections or the success. There's so much success and there is a level of emotional connection that it creates a genuine overall warmth and feeling. That's very rare in the world of sports, in my mind. Alabama fans worship Nick Saban, but would they worship Nick Saban if he wasn't winning? No, because he's not the guy who's going to create that. They worship him in the Wes Kanan, Bud Kilmer kind of a sense. You know that reference?
That
Varsity Blues?
Yeah, movie? I was going to say it's Varsity Blues or Friday Night Lights, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Varsity Blues. So at the end of the day, every coach is a hired gun. But fans seem to conflate coaches with the program. You have to support the coach blindly because he is the figurehead of the program, and therefore to knock the figurehead of the program is to knock the program itself. I don't believe that to be the case. There is a cult of the coach that is built amongst fans of all programs, of all teams. But I don't know why that really exists, because at the end of the day, the coach is there for a reason and they are deriving a certain value out of it. And that's all they need. They don't really care one way or another about being built up as legends or anything like that. They're there to get paid and they're there to win games doing the thing that they know best in terms of their own knowledge and skill set and life. They were bred as football coaches because they grew up around the game. They played the sport, so on and so forth. Basketball coaches, same deal, all that kind of stuff. I don't know why the cult of the coach really exists. Unless, like, you are a Greg Popovich or I don't even want to say Bill Belichick. I know Pats fans revere him, but it's similar to Saban in that way. Like an Alex Ferguson in soccer. And not to go soccer. I know everyone hates when I talk about soccer. But, like, that kind of a thing where it's just, this guy is this program. They're, like, synonymous with each other. Unless there is something like that, then I don't know where the cult of the coach comes from. I really don't. So those are the two things. I'm not trying to be negative for the sake of negativity. I'm just calling it like I see it. And second of all, I don't understand why there is this conflation between a person and a team or a program or a symbol or whatever you want to call it. Cults of personality are just bad in my mind in general. And you can apply that to whatever level of life you want. I have obviously ulterior motives in saying that, but cults of personality are just bad in general. I don't think that I am bringing down the UCLA football program by saying that Chip Kelly is doing a bad job, by saying that Jim Mora had checked out on the job, that Steve Alford was a bad human being. I don't think I'm doing anyone a disservice by saying that. These are verifiable things. So anyway, that's the end of my rant.
No, thank you. I endorse everything you've said. I think that in addition, I will add two things. One, I recognize that people, particularly if you are part of a if you're part of a fan base of a team that doesn't have
it isn't part of constantly part of the national conversation for positive or for negative. People get excited gravitating towards other people that care about this and want to talk positively about something. I remember, you know, when I first discovered that there were, you know, websites online that fans and or writers like talked about UCLA and shared videos of things that I remembered seeing, as you know, because I had lived all the way over here, you know, on the East Coast for a while at that time. And like, it was always just kind of a me thing. And to realize that, like, oh, I could plug into this, and the positive vibes I get from, you know, sharing experience and sharing joy with folks, you know, that also care about this is, you know, I get that that's real. And so I get that also then that when, if it starts to become negative or not even necessarily always negative, but like, it can be jarring then to hear those sources that you've put your faith in to say, oh, okay, this is going to be, you know, a place where I can, you know, get that fix of, you know, boosting this team that I love. When you hear something negative from there, like, it can be jarring and almost more offensive than if you heard it from anywhere else. And so I recognize that and I get that. I think that the two things that, you know, beyond everything you said, that drive the way I approach this is, part of this is, and we've talked about this before, it is a defense mechanism through humor. It is being able to keep when things are going poorly, to keep it at enough of an arm's distance so as not to just wallow in angst and actual, a despair, right? When you see a program when you start to say, like, I have given so much of my, you know, life and hours and energy and dollars to, you know, identify with this, you know, with this program, you know, for better or for worse, that we identify with these things as if they're parts of us, as opposed to just, you know, groups of kids playing, you know, in exchange for scholarship money. When you do that, it's hard to see it go down in flames. And so you say, hey, let's just keep it at arm's length. Let's have some fun in it, some gallows humor. And that's a way of getting through. And that's a little bit of just my personality and my defense mechanism. I know that it's a little bit of part of yours as well. I think it is pervasive on the internet, but probably more than it should be. But it's not for everybody. And I get that. But that's part of why I do that. Why, you know, I want to, you know, roll my eyes and talk about, you know, oh, this awful thing that happened. Or, you know, if I can make a joke about, you know, just a random joke out of context about Chip Kelly being a bad recruiter, like, that it alleviates some of the disappointment that comes with thinking about the fact that, you know, this big hire we had has been a big swing and miss. And then the other thing that I'm trying to do, though, is I try to understand. Like, I'm trying to make sense of what, you know, if this entity that is UCLA Sports has as much impact on my, you know, emotional well-being or, you know, emotional state as it does, I'm driven to then understand why it does the things it does. You know, why the inputs to that emotional attachment process are what they are. And that means I'm going to explore when things go wrong, why did it go wrong? And when things have gone wrong in the same way over and over again and revealing patterns, you know, I want to be able to understand what that is and prepare myself to know that, okay, when this next thing happens, look for it to trip up here, because that's where these things always trip up. You know, obviously that can turn in, if it's unthinking, and it could turn into, you know, the battered Bruin syndrome, and, you know, can be tiresome. But I don't think on the face of it that that's an illegitimate thing to do. We don't have to always be boosting the program. We don't have to always endorse, you know, the decisions by the administration or the coaches. You know, the one time I almost got in deep trouble when working for gojobruin.com was when I responded to a guy to just be like, look, you know, what you're looking for, you're not going to get from me. That's my job. So maybe you don't want to read this website. Maybe you just need to go to the official page and read the, you know, news boosting press release things that you want, because that's going to be all positive. And then I got a note from our friends to say, like, yeah, that's the one thing that will get you fired, is if you tell people not to read the website.
but you seem more interested in propaganda than you do in actual analysis.
And you know, if that's, I don't want to stand at a great height and pee on that and say that that's just awful and illegitimate. You know, it is
exists a way for a reason. People enjoy it for a reason.
Yeah, but that's not how I
do it. And that, you know, that's not how I enjoy or how I engage with the, with this. And that's going to inform how I talk about this stuff.
No, I completely agree. And one thing that you and I have in common, among the many things of just being, you know, awesome people in general, sure, and, you know, gentlemen,
yeah,
and scholars.
Undeniably
and
so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. you and I both come from backgrounds that are related to historical analysis in one way or another. Did you major in poli sci?
Yes.
Okay, I've never asked you that. I it was either history or poli sci. I'm a poli sci major as well, with a minor in history. Both of us have, through academic training over the years, kind of I don't know whether it's adopted or implicitly kind of absorbed an analytical style of those who don't learn from history or from current events are doomed to repeat them. So when you were mentioning, I need to analyze this in order to understand the why, in order to have a better sense of way things could potentially go in the future based on certain risk factors and so on and so forth, I completely related to all that as well, because yeah, it's almost like the way that when Tracy Pearson talked about the fact that, oh, UCLA needs a young and hungry coach because those are the ones who, when they're on the upswing of their career, rather than somebody who has, you know, kind of crashed out of the NFL or not the NBA on the basketball level, but somebody who has shown a modicum of success but is still working their way up the ladder and has a visible hunger for XYZ, it kind of clicked. They're like, oh, wow. Based on historical factors, I can see how you could point to this and it would lead to this. But this other thing leads to this, which is why I am somebody who has consistently said, because of UCLA's track record hiring people direct from the NFL, I will never be behind them doing it ever again, because I'm so scarred by them hiring Dorrell, Neuheisel, Mora, and now Chip. And so history and current events give you the context for analysis to have a certain sense, a perception for what is to come in the near and long-term future. And that allows you to kind of ascertain to a certain extent the way you want to frame discussions and the level to which you truly, even if you have a platform like this where you and I, we enjoy talking to each other, but also because we have a dedicated listener base, we have a sense of obligation to them as well to kind of deliver things that they're looking for. And we enjoy hearing from them, engaging from them as well. So it's not a chore of any sort necessarily, but on a personal day-to-day level, hour by hour kind of a level, game by game kind of a level, how much do I really want to invest in this? Because if I know going in based on these risk factors that there's a more than likely chance that we're going to go 4-8, 5-7 every season in football, do I really want to plan my Saturdays around that? Like that kind of a thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it is a discussion for the sake. It's casual fan discussion. It's casual fan discussion that really is not having any sort of intangible cultural and emotional, attitudinal, personal impact on anyone. And it's also allowing us to kind of get into the nitty gritty of the things that do and don't matter for an investment that we are making with our time and our attention and our energy and our dollars and so on and so forth. All of these factors come into play. So where to the point where if I make a joke about, just like you said, if I make a joke about Jim Mora, it's because I know that there were 4 years of Jim Mora where I wanted Saturdays of my life back because he didn't care about this as much as I did. So that is something that lays the foundation for me making that kind of a joke, for our listeners asking that kind of a question because they have curiosities about what went on at that time. We still have people who are born in the 70s and 80s who become scholars and PhDs in the Civil War and in World War II and stuff like that. That's not relevant to their current lives in terms of being able to draw a straight line, but these are things that history fascinates people, and you can draw lessons from that history that allow you to to frame the way that you contextualize things in the present and the future. And so all of these things are at play when you and I are having these discussions. It's not that we take any sort of pleasure or relish in any way the fact that things aren't going well, and so we get to knock on these people and feel superior or better than or anything like that. It's just, no, it is a realistic, plain analysis of what we see in front of us, but we wish it were better. And we are looking for the threads that we can pull out to say, oh, this is getting better. Or we're looking at the overall picture and saying, oh, there's not much hope. There's not really much to pull on and kind of pull on that thread. So all of that is at play, I think. It's a multifaceted, multi-layered kind of a thing. But in general, we are not negative for the sake of being negative. We discuss for this. We discuss because it's what we see and what we perceive.
Yeah. So I think that's probably enough. I think as much as I failed to keep myself from doing it, I am allergic to this kind of self-indulgent talking about our Twitter mentions on the podcast. But you know, I think it is good to kind of every once in a while, especially if we're getting new listeners, now being on board with West Bruin, to kind of set expectations about this is how we're going to approach it. And that may not be to everyone's taste. And hopefully the balance of our discussion on, UCLA sports will, bear out that, we come to this with, with good intentions and not like just trying to, find something that people love and bash it.
Exactly. Absolutely. We invest our time and energy into this too. If we were here making fun for the sake of making fun, we would really be doing it implicitly to ourselves as well. And neither of us has any real intention of dunking on ourselves in any not unwitting way. We'll do it with full self-awareness at times, but we're not going to clown on ourselves unknowingly. So,
All right. So
on that happy note, we didn't really, we're on the What's the Bruin Network. How can the people find us, Nathan?
Oh, don't ask me that. I don't know how to answer those questions. My goodness. This is what I get for not asking you, is it'll get sprung on me.
What's that?
I said, that's what I get for not asking you, is it'll get sprung on me.
Exactly. I guess we get to wrap up with it today. We are a proud member of the What's Bruin Network. What you want to do is you want to go to your podcast player, if you're not already, and subscribe to the What's Bruin Show Network. You put in that exact search term, and that's where you'll be able to find more of our content and more of our brothers at the What's Bruin Symposium and at West Coast Bias. We also engage on social media. The show is at UCLA B Team. Nathan is at Side Out Par. I'm at Michael M. Hanna. And we're also on Facebook at facebook.com/UCLA B Team. Engage with us. Enjoy. For those of us who are listening to us for the first time, either today or have recently listened to us for the first time in the last couple of weeks, we are thrilled to have you on board and hope to deliver quality content and conversation into the distant future for as long as we can. And for those who have been longtime listeners, thank you so much for your steadfast and loyal support. And we hope to continue delivering exactly what you've been coming back for on a weekly basis. And hopefully everyone who's listening in general, I know we did a little bit of navel gazing today, but just in general, enjoys the fact that enjoys what we try to do in the way that we do it.
Awesome. But yeah, so we will probably be back next week. But as we get into this time of the year, probably no guarantees. But the intention will be to be back next week. And yep. Until then, go Bruins.
Go Bruins.